pedestrian in a way. Part two is more violent, reflecting the violence of the time period. We end part one with something being established. We end part two with something we feel as if something is being destroyed, which it was. And part three, in each of these sections lasts maybe about 45 minutes or so, or 50 minutes or so. Part three is the present day. You know, what kind of ruins of the system are we living in? A system dominated by Kickstarter values versus publicly funded values or things of that nature. Yeah. And that part three is really based upon a lot about in-person, on-camera, oral interviews that I've been doing with European arts leaders, American arts leaders, which is why I was here in the first place. I got this grant from Finland to be over here. And kind of looking at the present day, because the arguments that were used and the methods that were used in America have been replicated in country after country after country.
Does anybody win when those arguments get their way in the end? Is anybody better off?
In an American context, some people are better off because some people benefit from a closed private philanthropy funding system. If you are born into a certain network of people, you have access to that funding stream. If you're not born into that funding stream, or you don't have access to some way to get into it, it's a closed thing. So some people do benefit, but
and it's the same argument for paying for private schooling, not because they'll be exposed to better education, but because they'll be exposed to more lucrative social connections.
Yes. There's a fantastic book that you should check out. It's by an American historian who died in 93 or 94, but his name was Christopher Lash, and he wrote this famous book in the 70s called The Culture of Narcissism, which is a masterpiece and a big influence on just about everybody. But on his deathbed, he wrote this another book, which I think is even more important, and he called it The Revolt of the Elites, that the real threat to democracy was not the masses rising up and taking over control of things. It's actually the elites basically removing themselves from society and democracy and basically just living this self-enclosed world.
Yeah.
I should have talked more about the piece, but
no, that's all right. Do people leave? Have you presented it anywhere yet?
We did a workshop last year in New York, just a short one, because the piece was very early at that point.
Yeah.
We haven't. I've been doing all the work, really the heavy lifting, since then, in terms of design, the blueprints, and the designing of the content. So it's all ready to go now. And now we're just trying to find co-partners to premiere it next year.
Dollar bills.
Yeah, or euros. One of the.
Yeah, exactly.
Or both.
There was something that I was going to ask. And it was about the piece, and it was about performing it. It was about, okay. So, especially when it comes to performance, I guess, and live performance and physical performance and dance and choreography, there was quite a revolution around the 60s in New York, the 70s, and that's still influencing Australia.
Okay.
I didn't see that as much when I was there last month, and I wonder if I just didn't see it, or I hope that you will be able to enlighten me, that there was a certain set of circumstances around that time period that can one day happen again, and that more revolutions of thought and form and medium can come that are not just, I guess, the dot-com equivalent of what we were talking about before, where there's actual work being done and actual discoveries being made, rather than extrapolations or rebranding of other things.
Yes. Well, I mean, I think when you're talking about that, and again, my dance background is not 110%, but by any means, but I think the movement you're talking about, the developments you're talking about, happened in a time period in New York when people had the time to actually make work.
Yeah.
Because the cost of living was so different and space was so much more available, and that it wasn't actually publicly funded space, it was just, you know, abandoned space.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, the American visual artist David Vonarovich, who was working in the 70s and the 80s, you know, a lot of his early work was made in abandoned buildings that we'll never see that work ever again because the buildings have been destroyed. But I think the conditions you're talking about in the dance scene were possible in New York because there was just so much space, and there's just not any space left anymore in New York. There is
not monetized.
Yeah, there's the ability to make work has been seriously compromised because all your time goes to paying your exorbitant rent, which is insane. The rent is insane. And I think the discourse in dance has shifted to Brussels because of the subsidized system here and in the parts school and the concentration of, I guess, in terms of what I see as an outsider or someone who, you know, is not 100% in the dance scene, that it seems to be more refocused over here because there's a lot of space still.
Yes.
And a lot of time is allowed, and it's possible to do things that you can't do in New York anymore. Is it possible in Detroit? Is it possible in some other regional American city? I think yes, but the people have to be living there to make that
discourse happen. There's like there's the physical space, but then there's also somehow what is the idea? So you need the brain space or the desire or the thoughts or the friends or whatever that
Hello?
Bring it about.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. But then you also need to
need the feedback, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And you need to have been exposed or stretched enough that you can feel when that's lacking from your life as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think I grew up in a very small town called Darwin, which is right at the top of the middle of Australia, always hot. It was under 100,000 people when I was born there. And I don't know if I really felt like something was missing until one day I stumbled upon some boys that were breakdancing. And it was such a shock to me that an entire culture existed that I was really interested in and felt like had room for me within it that I had not seen in the first 18 years of my life, that was enough for, like, it was enough of a stretch to know that when it wasn't around, it was missing. And it's really easy when you're in a place that has enough space and enough time and enough leisure that actually there's also not enough. I forget who I was listening to. They were talking about, I was reading something about New York being especially especially productive because so many people living there have been displaced and they come to New York to be able to find out who they are and work all these things out. Or they come to New York with other influences so that there's no such thing as the norm almost.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I don't know. Do you know where it's happening? Do you know where it could happen next? Because I feel like Brussels is halfway through its dash.
Well, I can talk about it in a New York context is that I think people are finally waking up now that the idea of moving to New York and living there and trying to make something work or happen there is just not possible anymore.
Yes.
And I think there are quite several great options or alternatives still in the same state, you know, less than an hour drive away or an hour and a half drive away. I mean, New York State is filled with small regional cities and towns that are just, you know, been obliterated by the last 30 years of Reaganomics. And you can easily get to them from New York City by public transportation. And I think you're starting to see more and more people realizing they can have a better quality of life in these just abandoned, horrific, you know, industrial wastelands of Hudson, New York, or Newburgh, New York, or Monticello, New York, or Binghamton, New York, all along the Hudson River region. I think people, or a lot of people I know, or a lot of people I see, are moving to places like that because they just can have the space and time to do what they want. So I think it's still possible there. Unless you have a complete revolution in the New York City landscape, which is also possible, where they advocate for more publicly funding space, publicly funded space to make these artistic projects happen, which you're seeing some people waking up to realizing now that it has to happen or else the whole thing could vanish, because New York's whole cultural capital is on the verge of being eliminated because people can't afford, the artists can't afford to be there anymore. You know, which was the whole point, you know, Patti Smith and you know, the visual artists and the punk scene and all that stuff, you know, yeah.
Yeah, so. The cost of rent is not actually the cost in money, it's the cost of cultural capital moving away. There's, you just reminded me when you're talking about up and down the Hudson, there's a very beautiful book if you ever get to read it. I mean, it's a little, it's written for people younger than us, but it's called Sailor Twain, and it mm-hmm. basically is just a graphic novel, and there's a steamship that goes up and down the Hudson carrying people, and it talks about the life of the river and a mermaid, but a mermaid as a metaphor for the whole area and what it means to be in the area. I wanted to ask you about inspiration, because in some ways we're just problem solving, and this is something we need to deal with because it is a disgrace, or it's disgusting, or it's offensive, and so there's like a reaction or a response. But what are other things that inspiration, like inspiring or exciting, or a book that really enlightened you, or a movie that you're like, if I can do that but in live performance, or I don't know, something like that.
Things I get inspired from? I get inspired a lot by visual art. I get inspired a lot by like installation, film installation or video installations. I get inspired a lot by watching a lot of dance or movements, and I don't understand why we can't bring more of that into theater or into the performance world, in the theater world. Why does everything have to be so you know, well-dressed white people on stage talking about their problems theater, you know? Why can't it be more of an installation or a happening, or have some greater degree of physicality attached to it? So I love seeing a lot of things that are not theater, I guess, and I get a lot of inspiration from that. I get a lot of inspiration from just weird things too, like, you know, news stories or advertisements I see, or actually I get a lot of inspiration from music videos. I watch a lot of music videos.
Oh yeah? And, you got a top pick at the moment?
I have a couple actually, but I can bring them up in a second. But there's this video I saw just last night by a band called Daughter. It's called Doing the Right Thing, and what they're doing in this music video is just insane. It's like it could be done in theater. It's just amazing. There's a couple of directors. There's a guy named I can't remember his name right now. Shit, sorry, I'm cursed again. But we watch a lot of music videos in my theater company. We watch a lot of music videos, and we kind of see how that happens there. That's what we have to go for, or yes, something like that.
Yeah. I am often finding the same thing when I'm working about how to do something live, and the effect that I want is already a staple in cinema.
Yes.
And it's either when I'm speaking about the choreography or about the lighting that will support the pulling off of that choreography, or the sound, because
yes,
it really, I feel like I can go to many cinemas all over the world and I get surround sound, and yet I go to a theater and stereo is like, I should feel grateful that I've been given a speaker for my left ear and a speaker for my right ear, but I want subs under the seats rumbling me, I want speakers above, I want like one behind that can move me through space sonically in the same way that the choreographer is obviously trying to do visually.
Well, have you heard about this British artist, Ant Hampton? He's a theater performance sound artist, Ant Hampton. Mm. He actually puts headphones in people's ears during a theater performance, and sometimes you're outside listening to things, or sometimes you're in a theater listening to things, and there's either no movement, or you're just listening with these headphones, or you're actually following instructions on these headphones inside the theater. I saw something at the Verrat recently in Ghent called The Extra People. That was pretty incredible. But he has these in-ear headphones that, I forget what the actual technical term is, but because of the range of the headphones, he's able to design multiple layers. And so you actually sound like you're in a massive space with all these different layers of sound coming at you, but it's all coming through these very tiny in-ear headphones.
There was one show that I was a part of in Vienna a few years ago. It was remount by a choreographer called Davis Freeman, and he had those cones, like the old Get Smart TV series, and these cones of silence would come down, like those around the room. And so if you were standing 1 meter to the left or the right, you wouldn't hear anything. But as soon as you walked underneath it, it was like somebody was whispering just in your ear.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was really beautiful. And then another piece that I saw in Berlin, and it sounded like something was coming from behind me, but I couldn't quite put my finger on it. I love the things that I'm not quite sure if they happened or if I've been encouraged to imagine them. And there was one of the performers had somehow snuck off stage and come around to the back of the seating bank and had something that looked like a satellite dish, which I guess was obviously a very, very directional speaker, and was just pointing it at different audience members from behind them.
Mm.
But it wasn't the whole show. It was just like a very specific part. Sorry, I cut you off. What were you
talking about? No, that's fabulous. That sounds actually fabulous. Mm. I mean, I know Freeman, and I know his work pretty well. I didn't see that one that you mentioned, but he had this series of installation pieces that was in New York, where you would go from different room to different room, and you had to go there the day before, and they took a photograph of you.
That's the one. I performed in the nude room, or the underwear room, where it's just like you against your corporal self.
Yes,
and they're doing
yes,
animalistic movements. But there was a room in this particular incarnation that had voices talking.
Too shy to stare.
Yes, that's it.
Yes. Oh, yeah. You were in that.
I performed in it in Vienna. He did a remount for it 2010 for the Impulse Tanz Dance Festival.
Yeah, he did another version of it in New York, cool. I guess in 2012 or whatever. It was fabulous.
It was. And as part of being in it, we had double cast. So if you weren't in it, you could go around to the rooms if there was a small crowd or whatever. And I got to go and... Did he have the room where they played you your obituary?
I forget.
Song that might be played at your funeral.
I forget. Maybe.
It was so beautiful. Like, I walked in and I handed over my portrait, and it got put on, not a casket representation, but just on a table the way that is often at a funeral service.
That wasn't in that one.
Percussionist played something for me based on me being there in my portrait original in the moment. That was, it was like being present at your own funeral. It was very surreal.
Wow.
And very, like, much more than the sum of its parts. And that's what I'm always trying to search for when and what I hope to find and what I don't get out of a lot of sports, for example.
Yes.
Well, maybe doing them. I get it out of doing them, but not watching it.
Well, yeah, you mentioned sports again, and that's something I wanted to go back to if I could very quickly. But then I also have to wind down, I think, in probably about 5 minutes because I think I have to give my apartment back to his friend. But the thing is that the sports thing, the funding thing is great that people come together and do that. And you said that it was kind of also its own self-enclosed world, right?
Yeah, we're playing for each other in whatever we do. If we're guitar players or darts players or dancers or DJs or race, like I used to race cars when I was a teenager, and you're not doing that for anyone. Like, you think you're doing it for hot girls, but really you're doing it for the other mechanics in the team.
Yes. I mean, all these things are, I guess with all these things we're talking about, whether it's sports or arts, there is an element of performing it for our peers, and that's never going to change. I guess my big stickler is that I always thought that there was something about the arts and humanities that could affect public discourse. And like, we can't talk about repetitive foreign policy failures, about how our government responds to genocide around the world at a football match. We can't, there's no discourse that can happen there for that. And I thought the arts and humanities, that's the place it could happen. And like, we come together to see a work, a performance or a film that deals with that, and then we can talk about it or have some entryway into it that's more accessible than a policy paper.
Yes, or at least hits us much harder. There's something that we already know, but by being exposed to it viscerally,
And then you see it, and then you go home and you read about it, and you're more sensitive to it when you see it in the newspaper, or you're more sensitive to it when you hear a politician talk about it. And that's what I think is the danger of what you lose when you don't have this publicly funding of the arts and culture, is that you're losing people coming together to be in the same room or have a discussion about things or an experience about things that... I think it's one of the reasons why we have such a hard time solving problems, is because we
don't have the tools to solve them, don't have the language, don't have the infrastructure of mind or of community or of...
Or the shared experience, we're in our own little cul-de-sacs, and we have all these refugees coming across the border, and how do we respond to it? We don't know how to respond.
How do we realize that they would happily live in their homes if we didn't bomb their homes?
Right.
And that everything is a direct response... when we're such big players because of the country's wealth. Maybe you've already answered one of my last questions, was just how big we should think as artists. And I guess you've already answered it. Well, we should think that we can somehow create and facilitate and invite for this. Yeah.
I think we have to think bold.
Mm.
And I'm all for aesthetic experimentation, and I think aesthetic experimentation helps fuel big projects in the future, or helps contribute to big waves that go forward in the future. But I think we have too much of the scale of towards that, and not enough towards some big bold initiatives or big bold projects. You know, we used to think more boldly, I think, and now we're thinking more in terms of small. And this foundation that I was supported by in Finland, the Kona Foundation, it's their mantra that they want bold ideas. They want ideas that are not just going to support an artist or a project, but actually help push the conversation forward somehow.
Mm.
And I think we've forgotten that.
So would you say that's your biggest hope for all of the efforts that you're putting into all of this and for the world? And
for the arts, I think yes. For the arts, I think yes. For other projects I'm working on, I just want to kind of dick around. you know, I don't I don't really care about any larger social engagement. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And quite often you don't understand your impact until after the thing has manifested and then been shared with people, and then you've been doing what 2 or 20 or 50,000 other people had imagined and didn't have time to see, or because a project takes 4 or 5 years from concept to production.
Yes.
By the time you're there, maybe it's super topical and maybe it's not for another 50 years, and maybe it definitely has had its time passed because it was
topical. No, I think there's room. I think we need some type of international tribunal that that says, okay, this project needs to happen this year. Yes. Let's allocate resources to that right now, because we did the WMD project. We thought of it in 2005, but it didn't premiere until 2009.
It's not quite on the tip of people's tongues anymore, is it?
Well, especially when Bush is no longer in the White House. But, you know, I mean, on the other hand, like, you know, there's projects that I just want to work on, like, right now. Like, I'm sitting in my friend's apartment having this conversation, and he told me about this this text that he wrote that was directly taken from, you know, in, like, do you have TV Guide in Australia?
Hmm. Yeah, it's a magazine, isn't it?
Yeah, like they publish the listings of what's on TV that day,
And they make up, like, a whole bunch of stuff about celebrities as well.
Yeah, and then there's always like a little couple of sentences about what happens on that episode of the show. Maybe it's not common anymore because we've totally on satellite networks now and we're not on the same schedule. But you know, I'm sitting here in my friend's apartment and he basically made this. Text, this script, this very abstract script in a way, but it's all directly lifted from these descriptions of a Belgian soap opera that appeared over the course of years in the daily or the weekly version of a TV Guide here, and since he presented the idea to me, I'm completely obsessed about it. He's probably listening to me right now, but
what's your friend's name? Should we name him? Should we give him credit for this?
We should give him credit for this. His name is Boris.
Right.
Boris van den Eyden. And ever since he showed it to me, I'm just obsessed with it. And the way he describes the project and what he wants to do with it, and he wants to actually perform this text as almost like an opera. It's constructed of these 3 or 4 sentences from daily listings in the TV Guide. Hmm. And it's insane. And I don't know if it's connected to any type of larger social engagement or social initiative, but I just want to hear what he has to say about it and fuck around with it and see what happens with it. And so there's two different sides of my brain. Like, I want to do stuff like that, but I also want to do other things that try to talk about the structures we're living in somehow. I don't know. And maybe this piece also does, that he wrote, talk about the structure we're living in because it's a TV Guide structure, but I don't know. There's different things that both have value.
Yes. Maybe I should let you go, mate.
Thanks.
I mean, unless you got... I feel like that's a real good part to wrap up on, because we're saying, look, sometimes you got to change the world and sometimes you just got to do something and hope that it matters.
Yes, yes. Well, thank you.
Yeah, no, thank you very much. I'm happy if you got any other wisdom or epiphanies that you want to drop, but... Or shout out or something.
Right now or
Yeah, you know, like someone says, tell me some epiphany, and then you just come up with one. It's as easy as that.
Well, I mean, the one epiphany I would say, because I'm talking to an Australian, is that when I saw the recent Australian announcement happen from the minister, that was, I guess, last month or 2 months ago now, right?
Yeah, he's gone now. He's not even the minister anymore.
Yes. One of the things I've seen is that in my research is that almost verbatim, country to country, when something like this happens, we respond with small scale arguments back rather than responding with the big narrative arguments that won the day in the first place. And that's one thing I would caution against in an Australian context, is that or even in a Belgian context, is that when these cuts are announced, or when these attacks are announced, or these things start to be implemented, not to be responded with small reactionary partitioned responses, but actually to go back to the original source things that won the day in the first place. Mm. That's something that I had an epiphany about recently.
Do you think the thing that won the day in the first place was public support?
Yes, but how we articulated that the way we went about it is what we have to go back and find. How we won it, you mean public support, that the more the public was for it?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think you're right, yeah.
I wonder if really we just, the only difference was that we were a bit louder as the public, or the democracy, or the people were a bit louder.
And whereas the public now, when arts cuts are announced, or when attacks happen, the public only is a public of existing artists, and that the general public themselves are not aware of the whole thing in general. That's a big danger.
It is a big danger. You got any breakthroughs about how to make it matter? Because I know there's a friend of a colleague, the mother of a colleague, and I was offering if there's anything else I could help her with before we left, because we had stayed on her farm in England, in outback England. Can you say outback England? Maybe outback.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Rural England. Yeah.
Rural. And she said to me, no, I can do all the things that I need to get done. I can't do the things that you do. And I just want you to keep doing those things so that they exist, and so that I can come and see them.
That's fantastic.
It was fantastic. It was a fantastic validation that there is some particular and rare quality contribution that people of skill and dedication are making.
No. It sounds like my first professional job was in upstate New York, in farmer country, very rural. And it was super professional theater, top actors from New York, from the UK, from LA, working in this small farming community where they basically, where New York gets all its milk from, and dairy farmers. And your story reminded me of how farmers would come from the fields and watch these productions and donate money. Just because they want to keep on having it in their community.
Yes.
I want to
keep on having milk from the farmers.
Yeah.
If I can get a lot of my family are cattle farmers or citrus growers or whatever, and I really feel the same. There's like, people have their skills, and if everybody is doing as most as they can with the things that they've been given, then everybody seems to, I don't know. It's just better, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It is.
Great.
Well, thank you, Matt. I appreciate the offer.
Mate, it's been very interesting. Pity we didn't meet in person, but I think it'll happen one day.
It will, yes. I will try and figure out some way to be in Darwin.
Excellent. All right, mate. Have a good whatever. Well, I mean, it's midnight here, so.
Yes. Rest of the afternoon. Thank you.
All right.
And I appreciate it, really. Thanks.
Yeah, great.
All right, take care.
Yes, did you? Bye.